everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
Good morning, Discovery. My name is Zach. I'm one of the pastors here. And we just sang a really great song and want to kind of keep us actually in that idea by actually starting our sermon today with what we would call around here a contemplative moment. You Call Me Loved was the lyric that we just sang over and over and over. We said that you're perfect and you call me loved, which if those two things are true, it matters. We're going to be talking a lot today about our actions and what we do, and I just want to acknowledge as we get in that these are things that we do not to earn God's love or approval, but as a response to God's love and approval. And so we need to talk about our actions today, but they have to be rooted in Him first. So we're just going to take a moment. You may want to close your eyes for this. Some of you, this may be a little like, this is weird, and I would just invite you, lean in. There may be something good here for you. But if you could imagine God's face, particularly His gaze, and He's looking at you, what word does He speak today over all of who you are? And for those of you who are like, I don't know much about this God, I don't know much about this story, there's some words on the screen that might help you settle in a little bit. But as you picture His face and consider what He says, take a moment to experience it. Our teaching today is rooted all over the 12th chapter of Mark's Gospel. And just to keep us from reading the whole chapter over and over and over, here's the part where I just go, this is the tip of the spear, starting in verse 41. He, Jesus, sat down opposite the treasury, the offering box, and He watched the crowd putting money into the treasury. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow came in and put in two small copper coins, which are worth a penny. Then He called His disciples and said to them, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury. For all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on." Here's a student at a school called Oxford in England years ago, and there was a pretty cool, now relatively popular story that was written about him. His first name was John, and let me just read a section of this story for you. John had just finished buying some pictures for his dorm room when one of the chambermaids of the dormitory came to his door. It was a winter day, and he noticed that she had only a thin linen gown to wear for protection against the cold. He reached into his pocket to give her some money for a coat and found that he didn't have any left. It struck him that God was not pleased with how he had spent his money. He asked himself, "Will God say to me someday, 'Well done, good and faithful steward, you've adorned your walls with money that might have protected this poor creature from the cold'? Oh, justice, oh, mercy, are not these pictures the blood of this poor woman?" As a result of that incident in 1731, John began to limit his expenses so he would have more money to give to the poor. I'll tell you the last half of that story in just a minute, but it's such a provocative story when we consider what we have today going on in our text. Have you ever found yourself in a moment like this? A moment where you just thought, I wish I could do something about this. And how does this compulsion, I think sometimes when we talk about giving, particularly when it's like in a spiritual context, giving at church or giving to like good causes out in the world, shame creeps in right away. I don't think I'm the only one that's like this, but when somebody asks if I can't say yes, and especially if I can't say yes at like a high, what I would consider meaningful level, I just feel bad. And I wonder if this story for John doesn't hit close to home for you as it does for me, a little bit of like, I just wish I could always say yes and just give everything I have. The story that we just read about this widow is a story about giving everything you had. And I think it's one of these stories in the Bible that can get jerked around a little bit, because as much as it's talking about money in this story, it's not really a story about money. That's not really what Jesus is teaching about here. He's teaching about something so much better. Now, as full confession, I came into this week with all my sermon prep, and I had like, here's a graph of how Discovery tithes its money. Here's where we give stuff, hoping to like pitch to you somehow, like this is a good place to give money to. And the further I got into the week, the more it's like, that is just so dim. Like that's just such a shadow of how good this conversation can be. So I will say this, if you're like, I would love to see a graph of how Discovery tithes its money, it's amazing. I mean, the story, it'll blow your mind. It is so cool. But as this weekend, this story unraveled itself for me, I was like, we have to spend all of our time there. That just matters so much more. So if you want to see that, let me know. But the context of this story matters. This is the whole of Mark 12. We're not going to have time to like unpack the entire chapter today, but we're going to unpack half of it. And that'll be doing actually pretty good work. The context matters. The whole Gospel of Mark is a total of 16 chapters, and starting in the beginning of chapter 14, we're into Jesus' death and resurrection. So if we say that we're starting in verse 12, we're kind of at the end. This is one of his last teachings. It's this last kind of dialogue that he's having on his way to the cross. We're meeting Jesus in his last moments here, and he knows it. I mean, if ever you see Jesus in the like, leave it all on the field mode, it's right now. He's giving the best of his best to his students. At the end of Mark 12, at the very end of the chapter, three pretty distinctive teachings come out, and they seem entirely random. The first one is this. We're not going to dig into it in reading it, but I'll tell you about it. All of these teachings are happening in the temple. They follow each other back to back to back. And if you've never seen a picture of the temple, I do think it's helpful to see it. Upper left is like the entire, what's now the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. That's what it used to look like back when it was Herod's temple, the temple that Herod built. The part right here in the middle, the bigger picture, is a blown-up version of that. And most of this story, as far as we can tell, for sure the last part, this last part we just read about this poor widow, is happening in this women's courtyard, the bottom right of the screen for you here. So I want you to picture this is where Jesus is. He's in the city of Jerusalem. He's in the temple of the Jews. He's in this particular place, the courtyard of the women, the women's court. And this is where these conversations will be happening. The first one that he has about halfway through, starting in verses like 28, there's this group of Pharisees. And if you're new to this idea, these were like the religious elite. These were like the pastors of the time. But they really are not too keen on Jesus. And so they corner him here in the women's courtyard. Maybe he's through on the priest's courtyard, but Jesus seems pretty pedestrian to me. He likes being with the people. He's somewhere in here. These Pharisees corner him and they say, hey, we have a question for you. What's the greatest commandment? And they're thinking, maybe we can trap him here. Remember, this is the end of Jesus' life and ministry. They're looking for an excuse to kill this guy. What's the greatest commandment? Jesus says, well, I would go with this, love God with everything. And love your neighbor as yourself would be the second most important. There's at least one Pharisee in the room who has a pretty interesting response. And his response is, you're right. That actually does capture everything that God's about. That is the most important commandment. And there's this really interesting interaction with Jesus and this particular, singular Pharisee. He says, you're close. You're close to the kingdom of heaven. In the Greek, the language would seem to lend itself to, you are so close, man. You are almost there. Agreeing that this is right, the mental assent, the ability to recognize a true thing, you're there. You're almost to the kingdom, though. And it seems to be that what Jesus is saying in that particular part of this three-part teaching is, you're so close. You've got it in your head. But the kingdom of heaven is not a mental exercise. It's not a list of doctrinal statements that you just agree with. So you're close, but there's more here. So if we could boil it down, the first part of this teaching of Jesus as he's walking around in this temple is this: love God with everything you got. And love your neighbor as yourself, but it's all summed up in love God with everything. Okay, cool. That's a good teaching. What else you got? And literally the next verses say this, starting in verse 35. While Jesus was teaching in the temple, he said, "How can the scribes say that the Messiah is the son of David? David himself, by the Holy Spirit, declared, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet.' David himself calls him Lord, so how can he be his son?" And the large crowd was listening to him with delight. As he taught, he said, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to have the best seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses, and for the sake of appearance say long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." It's a good sign that you've become a little too familiar with Scripture if you're hearing that and you're like, okay. It's a sign that you're either new or that you're paying attention where you go, what just happened? Like that, Jesus has severe ADD in this moment. I don't know what he just did, but we went from like, love God and love your neighbor. Here's something random about an old king. Why does he call God God? Isn't that strange? You're just like, this, what? Where did you just go? I don't know if you had that feeling reading that, but it's such a weird gear shift. Like this is like a totally different teaching, but he hasn't left the temple. Like he's literally going from one topic to the next. So what's going on here? We were just saying we were supposed to love God with everything. And it starts with this callback to a psalm. Jesus literally quotes in that moment, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand." He's quoting Psalm 110. So if we're going to try and figure out what is Jesus doing here, we've got to go back to Psalm 110. Let me just read the first three verses of that for you, and we'll try and get a little bit of an idea of what on earth did Jesus just do. Psalm 110, 1 through 3. "The Lord," capital L, "said to my Lord," lowercase L, "God said to me," David, King David, "sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord sends out from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your foes. Your people will offer themselves willingly on the day you lead your forces on the holy mountains. From the womb of the morning like dew, your youth will come." Also super weird stuff. But if we can boil this down and modernize the language a little bit, it goes like this. God says to David, "Hold my beer, and you sit there and watch this. I'm going to take care of all your enemies, and your people are going to get in on this victory." And if you want to, just as a fun exercise, go read the rest of Psalm 110 today. It's God. Like I picture, like almost like the genie from Aladdin, just like, step back and watch this. This is going to be amazing. All you got to do is sit there. And Jesus is picking up these particular verses wanting to do something really interesting. When you read the rest on your own, what Jesus is pointing out here, and to everyone who was present, this large crowd that had gathered in the court of women, was that everyone knew that from King David, from his lineage, there would be a Messiah, which is a fancy religious word for, there's going to come someday someone who's going to save us from all the jacked up stuff of this world. And if you've lived a life where you haven't ever touched or been touched by jacked up stuff, you're in the minority of people that don't exist. The world's a screwed up place. And this particular group of people had been promised, somebody's going to come and fix all this. I mean, it's a pretty big promise. Everybody's paying attention to, well, who is it? Where are they going to come from? He's going to be a son of David. That was just common knowledge. As the teachers have put it, he is the son of David. But Jesus asks, how can he be his son and yet someone he addresses with greater honor than himself? He says, Lord, capital L, said to my Lord, lowercase L. This would be like witnessing a grandfather saying to a grandson, "Yes, sir," but with like an air of the deepest respect, like he's watching his pleases and thank yous. Like, it's just an odd dynamic. And Jesus is saying, how come that's the dynamic that we see going on in Psalm 110? And I think there's a simple explanation here. If I was going to be the grandfather of a person who is going to save humanity from every evil, it makes sense. I would be doing the same thing. But Jesus is actually getting at a way deeper idea here. What is the Messiah going to be like? The context of Psalm 110 is all about the power of this Messiah, this God. And the way it was being read at the time, it's not just the strength and the kingly splendor of David that's giving honor to this Messiah. It's also the military ability of David. It's the golden age of Israel. It's all of this splendor and gold everywhere. That's being dwarfed by this Messiah. He's going to be even more powerful. There's going to be even more generosity. And where David and all of his armies ultimately failed to eradicate their enemies, this Messiah, he's going to finish the job. Jesus is really asking the question, is that what we're waiting for? What exactly are we waiting for? What's the Messiah going to be like? What's his power like? And why is David treating him with such respect? Is it because of his power? Is it because of his strength? Is it because of how he dresses and how rich he is? It seems to be squarely in his mind as he looks at these Pharisees, these religious elite, and says, beware if that's what you think. He's putting caution tape all over this idea, not only of what they were expecting this Messiah to be like, but what they all thought God was like. And it's showing up in their lifestyles, how they dress, how they treat things like money and power. Jesus is saying, you'll not only miss the Messiah if that's what you think he's going to be like, you're just going to miss God altogether. Beware. And I think I feel pretty comfortable pointing out that pretty much all of this room should be pretty uncomfortable right now, me included. It should be causing us to wonder how we treat money and possessions and power. The world of humankind has still not stopped worshiping these things, and suburban Denver is no different. And frankly, I'm no different. And this teaching asked me to inspect my life a bit. But this teaching also asked me to do something else as well. It asked me a question about what I believe to be true about the nature of God. These Jewish folks had been promised someone who had come to save them from the countries that had exiled and enslaved and oppressed them, sure, but also someone who would save them from themselves. That's one powerful person. Clearly a strong foreign policy stance, clearly some pretty strong counseling skills, clearly powerful. But what should we be expecting? What do we think he's going to be like? And not only what do we think he will do, but how do we think he will do it? And if we're really paying attention as good students, how do I reflect what I really think is worth worshiping? This whole section right in the middle may appear on the surface to be a moment where Jesus' ADHD just goes out of control. And he's like, here's a random psalm. Back to our normal schedule programming. What Jesus is actually doing here is he's teaching one thing. These Pharisees corner him and they say, what's the most important thing? And he says, love God with everything you've got. And now let me ask you a question out of Psalm 110. David's Messiah, what's he like? What's God like? And now, here's where things get interesting. He's still teaching the same lesson. You cannot look at these as these weird vignettes that are disconnected. He's answering the question he was asking the crowd. What's the Messiah like? How will he defeat his enemies once and for all? Object lesson time. And he walks over in this court of the women, and he awkwardly starts staring at one of the offering boxes. And it's super weird. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I have not, but maybe on your way out the door of just catching someone who's staring at every person who's coming and putting money in the offering box, we would kindly ask that person to stop if that was happening here at Discovery. This is a weird moment. I mean, the tension should be palpable if we're imagining the scene. You know where it's happening. Let me paint this picture a little bit more. If you were to walk into the temple at this point, particularly the courtyard of the women, there would be these 13 boxes that were stationed around the four walls in there. And these boxes, it's really weird. Looking at some of the research, they don't know if the horn went out or if it went in. But if you can picture a trumpet, which contextually this is like a ram's horn type of a thing, there was a ram's horn that was covered in bronze that was then mounted on top of these collection boxes. And what you would do is you'd come and you'd put your money in there. They put them in a horn for a couple reasons at least. One is that it looks really cool. Two is so that people, little kids, older kids, grown men, could not reach in. Like it funneled down enough that the only thing getting through there is the coins. So it's a security thing, which is smart. But if you can picture it a little bit, it's just a really interesting, loud thing. It's a way where you could hear what's going on. You could literally hear people tooting their horns, if you will. Here comes this widow. She's not just a widow, but she's poor, and she gives all she has. Okay, so we're not huge purchasers of bronze cupware and stuff in the Krieger house, but this is a Moscow Mule mug. Don't judge me. This is as close as I got. It's made in Turkey, even. So, hey, we're winning some points there, too. If you can imagine the sound of people coming in to this temple, and as they're giving money, and if we take in context what Jesus has just said to the scribes, some are saying loud prayers as they're giving their money. It's just, I mean, these big coins. And they're ringing in the trumpet as they funnel around and down in. And Jesus is just locked in on the offering box. And then all of a sudden, my grandma sent this to me about a year ago. This is a mite. This is what this widow would have had two of. I only have one. But this is what a mite sounds like going in to a copper mug. It's just so little. I mean, there's just not much. And I think the other really interesting thing about this story is, do you remember what she said? If you're thinking, I can't remember what she said, you're right. It doesn't record her saying anything. She's so humble. She's just simply given everything she has. And suddenly, the brilliance of Jesus' whole teaching moment begins to align. Here's the full lesson from our class today. Love God with everything. What's God's Messiah like? He's like a poor woman who gave everything she got. She gave everything she's got. She loves God with everything. Jesus looks at these Pharisees and he says, beware. You can tell that these guys think that God loves to be dripping in jewels and gold and fine clothes and power because of that, because of the way they live. But man, it's such a distorted understanding of what God's like, of what's godly. And then he turns to this woman and he says, here it is. You want to know what's God like? What God is like? Do you want to know how to structure your life? Check this woman out. Give it all. And man, simply intellectually agreeing that this is what God is like is one thing. You're close if that's the case. But really living it, to saturate your lifestyle in it, that's what I'm looking for. And the psychopath who's staring at the collection box all of a sudden is freaking out like a cartoon character going, Eureka, this is it. Pay attention. And he gathers his students back over and he explains the whole scene. Jesus is saying, I am the widow. The widow is as close to me as you'll ever get to understanding. You want to know what the Messiah is going to be like? He's going to be like this widow. You want to know what it looks like to give everything that you have for the love of God? Look at this widow. You want to know how the Messiah will show up, what he's like, how he'll defeat our enemies. Will it be with the pomp and the circumstance of a grand military or a coronation of elegance? No. He'll give everything. Literally, the clothes on his back and the final scene, or what will appear to be the final scene, will be a man literally with not even clothes, hung on a cross, dripping every ounce of blood and life that he has out of him, giving his all. So sure, this is the story of a poor widow, and it does involve money. But is this teaching about money? In one sense, yes. What should we do with our money? The same thing we do with everything else. You should love God and your neighbor with it, all of it. And there also seems to just be a bigger point here. It's not just about money. It's about your entire life. The example of Jesus, he wasn't just suggesting that it would be a good idea to love God with all you've got. He's showing us exactly how to do it. He's calling out the places where he's seeing it around, but then he finally just says, look, just watch me as I go. And now this teaching gets real, because where our eyes have been graced to gaze upon a story, now we're invited by Mark, as a good teacher and author himself, to turn our eyes upon ourselves. Where are we today? Are we close to God's kingdom? Are we living in it? Do we get it? Do you find yourself agreeing that the love of God and neighbor with all you've got is a good idea, or do you find yourself living it out? And before that pregnant pause allows the shame gremlins to go absolutely bonkers, I want to interrupt them with this reminder. What did he call you at the beginning of today? Beloved, or daughter, or cherished, he calls you that still. In this moment, no matter what your answer is to these questions, he calls me that still. And I'm so quick to despair or worship shame when I encounter questions like these, because in my heart of hearts, I know for sure 100% answer, I agree with it mentally. How much of my life is aligned with that agreement? Oh. But I don't know that shame helps us learn this teaching. And so I think it has to be set aside and silenced so that we can take the hand of a teacher who says, no, I'm dead serious about this. I think we find in this teaching a Jesus who loves us and respects us enough to do two things. One, to tell you exactly what life looks like, even if it seems out of grasp or really, really hard. And the second thing is this. He loves me enough to take one step at a time towards it, taking my whole life if it need be, which it likely will. He's good for that. We have to remember who he was talking to in this story. He's locked on the offering box, but the moment this whole scene happens, he calls over his students, the people that want to follow him and learn from him. He says, pay attention to this moment. Everything's happening right here. It's not just something we watch the Messiah do. He's asking us to follow him. He's asking these guys to pay attention to this woman. He wanted them to know how possible it was, how human it was to give everything. And then he did it too. And the crazy thing is, as we understand the book of Mark, we have no idea how the disciples respond in this moment. We have a pretty strong presumption that we can make based off of all the other lessons that Jesus taught, though. Their response was probably this: what? And the point for Mark is not trying to focus on how well did they follow the lesson plan. The point for Mark and the point for us is how well do you follow the teacher? Pay attention, and what's he trying to do? And I don't know what it is today for you, what his invitation is. This teaching is only partly about money, but it's really about considering what parts of your life you're holding back from God, what things you put your worship or your trust in, and choosing often with your actions to give up on those things and to choose often with your actions to trust in God. I know that when you've been drowning in addiction, choosing to take an action, to seek accountability and help. I know that's a way that you can love God with more of who you are, and today might be the day. I know that when you chase the insatiable appetite for fulfillment with fun or status or love from friends or family or lovers, it will simply leave you disappointed and resentful. And I know that if you trust money or comfort, choosing to let go of those things, which actually comes with incredible insecurity, can help you take hold of the only secure thing that this life actually has to offer. And as a teacher, I know that you don't paint the picture of a final destination and expect your students to get it right away. You know that picture as a teacher. You may even share that picture with your students, but a good teacher comes alongside you for the journey towards it and simply asks you to take one step at a time, and they're there to help with every step. We're not just looking for perfection, although we are, but we are looking for progress on our way to perfection. I'm going to invite the band back out as I finish the story of John. It's a guy by the name of John Wesley, was his whole name. The story ends like this. This guy who bought some pictures for his dorm room and then met one of the janitors. Perhaps as a result of this incident in 1731, Wesley began to limit his expenses so he would have more money to give to the poor. He records that one year his income was 30 pounds and his living expenses were 28 pounds, so he gave 2 pounds away. The next year, his income doubled, but he still lived on 28 pounds, and he gave 32 pounds away. In the third year, his income jumped to 90 pounds, and again, he lived on 28 pounds, giving 62 pounds away. The fourth year, he made 120 pounds, lived again on 28 pounds, and gave 92 pounds to the poor. Wesley preached that Christians should not merely tithe, but give away all extra income once the family and creditors were taken care of. He believed that with increasing income, the Christian's standard of giving should increase, not his standard of living. He began this practice at Oxford, and he continued it throughout his life. Even when his income rose into the thousands of pounds, he lived simply and quickly gave his surplus money away. One year, his income was slightly over 1,400 pounds, and he gave away all save 30. He was afraid of laying up treasures on earth so that money went out in charity as quickly as it came in. He reports that he never had as much as 100 pounds at one time. When he died in 1791, the only money mentioned in his will was the miscellaneous coins to be found in his pockets and dresser drawers. Most of the 30,000 pounds he had earned in his lifetime had been given away. As Wesley said, "I cannot help leaving my books behind me whenever God calls me hence, but in every other respect, my own hands will be my executors." For John, he learned exactly what he needed to live on. For us, how do you grow? What does progress like that look like today to give a little bit more away of the things you don't need to be trusting to grab hold of the one that you do? What does it look like today to love God with everything? And you might not be able to jump right to perfection at doing that. But a good teacher like Jesus is totally fine to say, "Progress. We're going to take one more step today." C.S. Lewis maybe gives one final nudge for us. If you're trying to figure out, well, how far do I go? What's the limit? I've heard in church that we just, it's 10%. We just lock in at 10%. C.S. Lewis says this, "I don't believe one can settle on how much we ought to give. I'm afraid the only safe rule is to give more than we can spare. You serve a God who loves you enough to be entirely clear about what he's after in you. And he loves you enough to be entirely gracious during the process. Beware and be aware of the gods that are vying for your attention. And for the one that you seek to serve, the one that I seek to serve, I just want a life that reflects what he's like. A Messiah who's not the military pomp and circumstance dripping with jewels, but one who says, I'd give everything to be with you. I'd like to respond in kind as best I can. And so I'll keep journeying towards this widow and towards the Jesus who saw himself in her. And if I can keep whittling down to my 28 pounds, or maybe even a little bit further, giving more than I can spare, could it be that sometimes the spiritual boredom that even I encounter is something that can maybe experience life again? For all the stuff and all the things that we can give money to, man, shame's just such a poor motivator. The motivation of this Jesus is he's looking at all these things and in all this teaching fundamentally comes back down to love. Love God with everything you've got. Don't let it be a shame-driven thing. Let it be a response to somebody who says, I would give anything for you, that you would simply say back, me too. For those that are able, let's stand and sing together.